Good day or evening, wherever you may be. I'm Glenn Tiffert, Research Fellow and Manager of the Hoover Institution's Project on Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region. On behalf of the Hoover Institution, I'd like to welcome you to the fifth session of our annual conference on Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region, which is devoted to the theme of democracy, good governance, and pluralism. In a region and world where democracy, good governance, and pluralism are experiencing intensifying pressure, Taiwan has been an inspiring bright spot. From its economic miracle and peaceful transition over the past several decades from one-party authoritarian rule to vibrant multi-party democracy, to the extraordinary effectiveness of its responses to the COVID-19 pandemic and to the scourge of online disinformation during its presidential campaign and elections earlier this year, Taiwan has set the bar high. Today, we explore some of the micro and macro level conditions of that success. We have an outstanding lineup of participants in store for you. So let me start by introducing the chair of today's panel, Dr. Lanny Chen. Lanny Chen is a Hoover Research Fellow and Director of U.S. Domestic Policy Studies in the Public Policy Program at Stanford University. He served as a senior official in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services during the administration of George W. Bush and has advised several U.S. presidential campaigns. A prominent observer and analyst of Taiwan affairs, he is a frequent media commentator and cherished contributor to this project. Lanny, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Glenn, and thank you to everyone who's joining us today, but in particular to the distinguished panel that we've put together to discuss issues of democracy, good governance, and pluralism. Let me introduce first the panelists and then our discussant for this afternoon or evening, and then I'll say a brief bit about the papers and the issues we'll be discussing today. Our first panelist, Dr. Lavina Lee, is senior lecturer in the Department of Modern History, Politics, and International Relations at Macquarie University. She's the author of U.S. Hegemony and International Legitimacy, Norms, Power, and Followership in the Wars on Iraq. Second is Dr. Qinzhou Wang, who is professor of political science at National Cheng Kung University. His research focuses on judicial politics. And finally, Dr. Karis Templeman is a visiting scholar at the Hoover Institution. Formerly, he led the Taiwan Democracy and Security Project in the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center, or APARC, at Stanford. He's co-editor of Dynamics of Democracy in Taiwan, the Ma Ying-jeou Years. And our discussant, of course, is a familiar face to all, Dr. Larry Diamond, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, who chairs Hoover's projects on Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region and China's global sharp power. A renowned expert on democracy, he's the author of Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. Today, we'll be hearing from our three panelists, as I noted earlier. We'll hear first from Dr. Lee, who has written a paper on how the PRC's Belt and Road Initiative undermines liberal democratic governance and why those who seek to support democracy should directly counter the BRI. Her focus is on the U.S.'s program recently announced by Vice President Mike Pence, the Indo-Pacific Transparency Initiative, or IPTI. She argues that the IPTI is key to countering the PRC's, quote, soothing and seductive messages. That is a very apt way of describing what Beijing is doing, these soothing and seductive messages behind the BRI. And moreover, the fact that these messages have a willing and receptive audience. Not only to the messages themselves, but to the values and perhaps more importantly, the material offerings behind the Belt and Road Initiative. She argues that the promotion of civil society, rule of law, transparent and accountable government offers an important counter to both the geostrategic as well as normative challenges posed by the Belt and Road Initiative. Secondly, we'll hear from Dr. Wang, who argues about the role of coercive activity and the link between the coercive activity, the judiciary, and the former ruling party, the Kuomintang in Taiwan. He looks at how the decrease of coercion diminishes or has diminished the ability of the KMT to control and protect its brokers or local politicians. He argues that democratization has decreased the role of coercion in Taiwanese politics, and in particular looks at the judiciary and the impact of the judiciary on Taiwanese democratic politics and the breakdown of KMT clientelism, and broadly, the KMT's impact on Taiwanese politics. And finally, Dr. Templeman will give us remarks from a paper entitled Countering Sharp Power, Lessons from Taiwan, where he discusses the resilience of Taiwan's democracy in the face of an aggressive PRC sharp power campaign designed to make Taiwan's political climate friendlier to the PRC's view of unification. He in particular discusses the resilience of Taiwan's democratic institutions, regulatory bodies with broad powers, independent and energetic prosecutor's offices, and an excellent system of campaign management. As someone who had the opportunity to witness Taiwan's presidential elections in January firsthand, I will say that Dr. Templeman's assessment of the Taiwanese system of campaign management, system of electoral balloting and counting is truly one of the examples for the world in terms of ways of ensuring a transparent and fully democratic process. So with that introduction, I look forward to this broad and wide-ranging conversation we'll have today on the topics of democracy, good governance, and pluralism. With that, Dr. Lee, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I want to first start by thanking Larry Diamond and Glenn Tiffert for inviting me to speak here today. It's a great pleasure to be here. Now, I wanted to speak to you about the BRI and the broader threat to democracy that it poses. The United States and other liberal democracies in the region oppose the Belt and Road Initiative on the basis that it is a grand blueprint to advance and entrench a dominant economic role for China within a vast region that stretches from East Asia to Europe and from the Middle East to Africa. The BRI is also frequently criticized as a blueprint to advance authoritarianism in these regions. However, it's not always clearly explained how the BRI seeks to do that. More explicit arguments are needed if the BRI is to be treated as both a material and a normative challenge to the US and the liberal rules-based order. In the brief time that I have, I want to offer three arguments and some empirical observations explaining how the BRI undermines liberal democratic governance and why democracy promotion ought to include efforts to counter key aspects of the BRI. First, the BRI is the main vehicle by which Beijing propels a grand narrative of Sino-centric success, opportunity, and guaranteed gains emanating from Chinese authoritarian capitalism. In many countries where political systems are assessed on their short-term economic and developmental outcomes rather than commitment to principles, the spread of autocratic values is achieved by the seemingly rapid economic outcomes the BRI can produce. China no longer shies away from proclaiming that it has perfected an alternative form of capitalism that is worthy of emulation because it can create economic prosperity without the supposed irrational and inefficient decision-making processes involved with liberal democracy. In his speech to the 19th Congress of the CCP in October 2017, for example, President Xi asserted that China's political model was, I quote, blazing a new trail for other developing countries to achieve modernization, and which offered a new option for other countries and nations who wanted to speed up their development while preserving their independence. Further, the Xinhua news agency openly derided liberal democracy as a system marked by, I quote, endless political backbiting, bickering, and policy reversals, which have retarded economic and social progress and ignored the interests of most citizens. The economic success of the China model, together with positive perceptions that such a system allows elites to govern efficiently and effectively, provide the building blocks for the promotion and spread of authoritarian values. The BRI takes this narrative one step further by demonstrating the success of the China model to the world and offering others a share of that success. As Xi has put it to Southeast Asian nations, when the big river is full of water, the small ones never run dry. It is important to note the absorption of these grand narratives and diffusion of authoritarian values finds a receptive audience among the populations of the many developing countries in the Indo-Pacific, in which a relatively shallow commitment to democracy and an openness to centralized rule has been observed. For example, a 2017 Pew Research Center survey found that only 15% or less of those surveyed from the Philippines, Indonesia, Vietnam, and India were committed Democrats, meaning that they rejected alternatives to representative democracy outright. These results are not necessarily surprising in societies where political systems, rather than political parties, are judged in instrumental terms and order and economic advancement are highly valued. Second, with respect to weak democracies and competitive authoritarian regimes, the BRI gives them the means, opportunity, and cover to resist external and internal pressure for more accountable government and greater transparency, the primary effect of which is to bolster regime security. Prior to the onset of the BRI, China was already implicated in directing aid and non-concessional loans primarily to other authoritarian countries. Empirical analysis conducted by aid data showed that from the year 2000 to 2014, the top 10 recipients of Chinese development assistance, of the top 10 recipients, six were dictatorships and three were competitive authoritarian regimes. When non-concessional loans were concerned, half the top 10 recipients were autocracies, three were competitive authoritarian regimes, and only two were democracies. Since the BRI was adopted as China's primary outward-facing framework from 2013 onward, these trends have accelerated. Indeed, the China International Development Cooperation Agency, the peak entity created in 2018 to coordinate the country's aid, has been charged with facilitating BRI projects as one of its explicit goals. Such foreign investment and aid is provided free from the usual IMF and World Bank loan and aid conditions, including demands for good governance, respect for human rights, market and liberal reforms, and is justified as being consistent with the strict adherence of non-interference in the internal affairs of other states. This stance, however, has the effect of insulating elites from external democratizing pressures. Cambodia is an obvious example of China's use of development aid and BRI funding to prop up authoritarian leaders, accompanied by a steep decline in democratic processes. There, the ruling Cambodian People's Party has steadily eroded multi-party liberal democracy, whilst receiving China's steadfast diplomatic support and substantial levels of aid and FDI. China has been Cambodia's largest source of FDI in recent years, and been between 2010 and 2016 gave 9 billion in aid, or equivalent to around 40% of the country's GDP. Preceding the 2018 election, the country's main opposition party was banned by the Supreme Court, while its leader was imprisoned for treason, with both events endorsed by the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi as an effort to, I quote, protect political stability and achieve economic development. Further, the BRI is designed to operate opaquely, and this complements and entrenches existing authoritarian practices that avoid transparent government decision-making. In contrast to multilateral development banks like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank or the World Bank, the BRI has no formal institutional structures and no set lending rules. Contract terms for BRI projects and MOUs signed by states that formally join the BRI are rarely made public. Most projects are not subject to competitive tendering, with new projects and successful tenderers simply announced. Authoritarian governments tend to work better with other like-minded regimes. They are more in tune with the other's overriding need for regime survival, and that the means by which they retain power involves enriching their patronage networks. The opacity of the BRI has proved to be a useful means for smaller authoritarian regimes and weak formal democracies to access external resources to distribute gains to their supporters and otherwise bolster their domestic rule. As such, they have no incentive to insist on competitive tendering or transparency in contract terms. In weak democracies, BRI infrastructure deals have been used by incumbents to counter falling electoral support among their major constituents, to demonstrate their economic development credentials and provide a sugar hit to the economy. Chinese SOEs have been willing to assist in this regime survival project by inflating BRI, provide opportunity for exerting political leverage for Beijing's own geostrategic ends. As the stronger player in a bilateral negotiation conducted without public scrutiny, it is able to insist on the delivery of projects by Chinese companies using Chinese workers and its own standards and dispute processes while asking for political concessions. These propositions are brought out in the recent case of Malaysia. There, it was the faltering of the country's economic performance that ate away at the electoral appeal of the ruling Barisan National Government toward an even deeper embrace of Chinese investment under the BRI. As the 1MDB scandal unfolded, Najib then looked to the BRI as a potential lifeline. In the course of Najib's ongoing corruption trials, evidence has been uncovered of Chinese officials' complicity in the financing of infrastructure deals at above market value, with the excess being used by Najib to bail out the excessive debts of political networks. This includes the US $16 billion deal to build the East Coast Rail Link, which the new Malaysian government estimated should have cost around $7.25 billion to build. Third, the export of China's surveillance state and pernicious illustration of the digital Silk Road arm of the BRI and its effect of undermining democracy and democratic practices. The model and tools for repression that have been developed and are being perfected in China, including the development of an algorithmic surveillance system to construct a citizenship score for each citizen by 2020 to incentivize good behavior, draws on online data as well as a growing network of surveillance cameras using facial recognition technology. Such technology is now also being used to repress the Uyghur minority in Xinjiang. Huawei is leading the export of this kind of technology and command systems under what it markets as safe cities, ostensibly as a tool of law enforcement, but with the obvious uses for authoritarian regimes. It is telling that the early purchases of Huawei's safe cities products and services were authoritarian regimes, including Russia, Pakistan, Venezuela, Laos, Angola, and Ethiopia. China's authoritarian challenge is a formidable one because there is a vast and receptive audience to its messages, values, and material offerings. The BRI might have begun as a relatively modest plan to further develop China's westernmost regions. But through the expansion of the BRI footprint, Beijing is challenging the decades-old assumption that political freedom leads to superior economic and social outcomes. The US and other partners need not counter all aspects of the BRI, but at a time when democracy appears to be backsliding or in decline in many countries, they do need to counter those specific messages, values and offerings that are being used to undermine political and individual freedom. Democracy promotion through overarching programs such as the Indo-Pacific Transparency Initiative is a key but underappreciated strategy to counter not only the geostrategic, but also the normative challenge of the BRI. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lee. Next, we'll go to Dr. Wang for his comments.
Thank you very much for inviting me to join this great conference. This today, not just only my study, just on not only apply to the KMT, but also the apply to the DPP. Yeah, in fact, I did not too much the DPT, but I think the something or the same the condition can apply to the DPP. Yeah, in this paper, I want to talk to Taiwan, the local collectivism and the corruption, Taiwan is the ranking one of the best performers in the Asia Pacific region, according to the 2019 Corruption Perception Index CPI issued by the Transparency International. I think Taiwan is ranking very, very high, and it's ranking the 28th, and the score is 68. I think Taiwan is much better than the Korean and South Korea, and just little p less than the Japan. So Taiwan Taiwan performance is very, very good. However, in the same time, we can see that this year this very famous the bribery scandal and just call a so-called case. He involved many lawmakers in from the different party. Almost in Taiwan, any major political party involved in this case. Like KMT, we seen the lawmaker Chen Zhaomin and Chen Dongmin, and the DPP working to see the most pretty important the Su Zhengqin. Even the Su Zhengqin just from my hometown district, and also the independent maker Zhao Zhenyu. And also our old friend, the MPP, the chairman Xu Yongming, he also involved. Although the Xu Yongming did not detained by the court, yeah. So my main argument is in this process, Taiwan judiciary had make pretty important though against the collectivism and the corruption, yeah. Even Taiwan the judiciary far more perfect, but I think Taiwan the judiciary is much the independence, yeah. So however, when we see the judiciary make many much more progress in Taiwan, also they had a good performance against the Taiwan the corruption. However, there are many serious limitations and the judiciary against the collectivism and the corruption. Yeah, I think that before we discuss that is how the judiciary against this kind of corruption, I think we have to remember, in fact, every Taiwan democracy and Taiwan judicial reform, independent reform did not begin when the Taiwan collectivism and corruption become very increasingly worse in the beginning of the democracy. In when in the survey after the democracy, I think more than 40% the survey responded consider Taiwan local government officially are corrupt, and the low-level officials are perceived as more corrupt compared to the central government official, because Taiwan most local elections just hold on the local, not the national level. However, I think KMT internal conflict, like the main the question, Zhu Liu Pai and now question now the main the conflict the the counter between the land, and the open is the political position like judicial legislative and the position. This is the open the sea, open the to compete with different companies. So the Li Denghui, I think it's very important. Li Denghui just broke the local position into the national party. So right now, in the past, the local elite only can explore the resource on the local government level. However, in this time, the kind of leader can explore and use the national the resource and avoid the national policy. Yeah. So I think that before we discuss, I see something that, pro table functional or judicial bureaucratism. I think one is very important is the purported voter buying during the election. I think the voter buying is very fundamental the part of the KMT, the criterium campaign machine. Without the voter buying, the KMT criterium political machine will not be the able to function properly and very, very well. So other the political use of the KMT criterium is to protect the criterium elite corruption. Because in the past, the KMT elite just can to use the corruption resource. However, no one to charge them. So I think the judiciary can protect them. So the KMT, the criterium elite, don't need to worry about to be charged. Yeah, I think we want to go to very detailed. I think Taiwan in the past maybe 30 years, Taiwan the judiciary have made much progress. I want to go to detail. I think the first one in the court system, we call a case assignment reform. In the past, the prior judicial reform, this case just decide by the chairperson of this court. And the chairperson was assigned by the judiciary, and the chairperson, the court can assign a very important case, particularly the corruption case, to the judge. The chairperson can trust. So this can the protect the KMT the criterion. To be charged. A second one is a personal constituent council reform. The person review the council, I think the judicial is control the judge, the promotion and punishment and principle. If someone, some judge can challenge the KMT, the policy or the KMT, the partition, they may be transferred to the rule, hopefully, far away the discord like the Hualien and the Pingtung and the Penhu. Yeah. Another reform in in the particular system. I think that before they start to the institutional reform, I think they are very, they are emerging a new generation the prosecutor. In fact, this paper very famous in the 1992 Hualien election case. I think the first one, successful investigation of voting flow in Taiwan. In fact, this we call the Hualien Zhoubiaohan, because this DPP the candidate is the chairperson of the DPP then Huang Xinjie, and they are only two the very very young, they are less than the 30 years old, Hong Zhenhe and the Lai Qingxiang, and two of both men, they are in charge of this case, and finally they charged the KMT the DPP KMT the candidate, and also they put the DPP to take the legislative yuan. And the second one we seen in 1998, I seen the prosecutor, this first time Taiwan prosecutor, they carry on the collective action. They just don't want to be the anyone political tool or rubber stamp or the intelligence. They claim that if they are the popular resource, they can carry on the mud, just corruption in Taiwan. So in fact, in summer, I think both the core and the prosecutor reform, you know, we can control any party, not just the party control, not just the KMT, but also DPP. In fact, in the past 10 years, I don't think the KMT and the DPP want to try to control the core and the prosecutor. Yeah. I think there are several practical consequences of the judicial reform on the clientelism and the corruption. I think the first one is the depression of clientelism to elite. In whether the KMT can, you know, if someone the clientelism elite want to deplete from KMT, the KMT just can use the legal way to punish them, this KMT elite. So KMT the elite the system cannot maintain the same. I think the second one, I think the KMT the system cannot continue to the computer system. I think the many local questions did not have cannot find very good candidate to run the campaign. So we can see many local patients, they cannot maintain their local organization, although they cannot maintain their leadership. This one, I think they are lose the judicial protection in the election. Because the KMT run the campaign, you know, they almost not everyone, but almost they use the voter buy-in. However, right now the police and the particular prosecutor later on, they against this kind of voter buying, they charge many politicians in this election. So I think this is a pretty good example. Many people don't see Taiwan the judiciary have become independent. However, in the 2000 legislation, you know, this is a very good example how the prosecutor and the court to against this kind of corruption. In this time when 2008, you know, the Ma Ying-jeou just won the presidency for almost the 60% more. In fact, the Ma Ying-jeou, you know, they win the DPP candidate, Xie Chang-ting, more than two million vote. Also, the KMT hold the seat, the third, fourth in the legislative seat. So in case the KMT, you can see the KMT control, dominate, excuse me, and the Congress. However, you can see in this year, you know, they are for the voting case, you know, they are charged the prosecutor and also, you know, another by the court. In way, this is KMT can still many people can see the KMT still control the judiciary. You can see the political landscape, the KMT control the presidency and the Congress, the KMT can still easy to control the judiciary. However, it's not. You can see the four the KMT the member, you can see Li Wutian, Jiang Lianhu, Liao Zhengjin, Li Shouwen, and another from the People First Party, Lin Zhenhe, they are also from the same Pempulu case. So you can see the court can challenge against this kind of corruption and the clientelism. Yeah. However, I still argue the court not do the same good. You can see I like to see the Pingtung case. You see the Pingtung the prosecutor office is the most reform-minded one in the prosecutor system in Taiwan since the 1990s. In the Pingtung case, they they prosecuted many politicians in Pingtung. However, you can see in 2016 and 2016, just 1 year, they attended 20 special, more than 20 special election. Why? Because several office holder was indicted by the borderline charge. So they lose their office, their position, and they need to a special election to replace. However, you can see the same, even the prosecutor charged so many cases. However, political party, not only the KMT or DPP, they tend to nominate their similar local elite to enter the special election. Like someone, the DPP, the candidate was charged the voter buying case. However, they send their daughter or their wife to go put campaign. And yeah, and another party, DP and KMT, also send this kind. And the Pingtung, the prosecutor office also charged both of them. So this kind of pattern, I think the state happened in the rural Taiwan, typically in the Pingtung. Yeah, so my conclusion is pretty simple. Yeah, judicial reform cannot make the law, a new candidate into the political area. So they cannot force some people into this campaign. Also, they can see right now the court and the prosecutor cannot make a new law to regulate the partition and the corruption the relationship. So I think this is very, very important. I think if we only rely depend on the court to challenge to against the clientelism and the corruption, I think there are very, very many serious limitation on this kind of strategy. So I propose the new phase or the new the political party to join the election. I think this is similar Taiwan problem, very, very serious. Like we can see the political power party, the Shidai Liliang don't have many candidates in the rural district. They have some good candidates. They are in the national level, like Wang Guoshang and Qiu Xianzi. However, in rural district, even in the Thailand city, they are only one city councilwoman. This is only one. So if you want to change this kind of thing, we need many new ways into the join this kind of edition. Also, we need you right now the nation, the Congress did not make many law to regulate the connection between the partition and the corruption. So you can see like Yuandong case, Yuandong even donated many money to the both party, major party. So the DPP, the candidate and the KMT candidate also received a donation from this kind of bigger corruption. I think this new challenge for Taiwan. Yeah, in fact, so I think my point is pretty simple. Judicial reform is much more progressed in Taiwan. So Taiwan judiciary is very, very independent, and it's very difficult for the political party to control the judiciary. So you can see in this case, the so-called case, yeah, three major parties, the KMT, DPP, and the Shidai Liliang, you can see three the major people, the member also involved in the case, and three members, you can see was charged. Yeah. So I think if Taiwan will want to go further to against the corruption and cartelism. We see new strategy. Yeah, this is my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wang. Finally, we'll hear from the last panelist, Karis Templeman.
My brief today is to cover Taiwan's resilience, democratic resilience in the face of PRC sharp power. And I think Taiwan is interesting for a couple of reasons. First off, it's really on the front lines of PRC sharp power projection. The CCP in China cares a lot about Taiwan. It's used not just covert influence, but overt influence. In fact, the full arsenal, the gamut of sharp power weapons that it can to try to make Taiwan more favorable to unification. And second, Taiwan, despite facing the full arsenal of CCP sharp power, has been a really tough nut for the CCP to crack. It really hasn't gotten very far in trying to promote a pro-unification identity or opinion in Taiwan. And so as a consequence, I want to talk about today why this is. So in particular, I want to focus on this period over the last 4 years where Taiwan elected a new, more China skeptical president and ruling party. In 2016, Tsai Ing-wen was elected president of Taiwan, and her Democratic Progressive Party won a big victory in the legislative race and won a majority for the first time. She did not, in her inauguration speech, endorse a one China principle that Beijing accepted, and therefore Beijing responded to her inauguration speech by rolling out a very careful graduated increase in sharp power pressure on her administration in an effort to try to erode her support and force Taiwanese voters to elect someone more friendly to unification. Her polling numbers ended up low for much of her first term, and this approach by Beijing appeared to be working. In particular, in late 2018, in local elections, the KMT, the more China-friendly party of the two major parties in Taiwan, came roaring back and won a significant number of local races, led by a formerly obscure populist China-friendly candidate, Han Guoyu, who won a stunning victory in Kaohsiung in southern Taiwan, in an area that had traditionally been a deep green DPP heartland. So it looked like the DPP might actually struggle in the face of this concerted effort by the CCP to undermine support for independence and promote support for unification. And then over the last year and a half or so, the pendulum has swung back towards the DPP in a very big way. So in January 2020, both Lanny and I were in Taiwan to witness. Tsai Ing-wen won big again. In fact, she won a larger share of the vote with a much larger, much higher turnout than she did in 2016. And so the CCP's sharp power campaign ultimately failed to achieve its primary objectives. The DPP is still in power. They still have not endorsed Beijing's preferred expression of the One China principle. And they look to be growing in strength and support in the electorate rather than shrinking. So let me talk a little bit about the elements of Beijing's pressure campaign. Beijing has for a long time pursued a kind of dual track sharp power strategy in the case of Taiwan. So on the hard track, when Tsai Ing-wen came into office, Beijing cut off the cross-strait hotline between the two governments. They ended all government-to-government official communication. They restarted the competition for diplomatic recognition. Seven countries since 2016 have switched recognition from Taipei to Beijing. They continued to squeeze Taiwan's international space. In particular, Taiwan representatives in the World Health Assembly and the International Civil Aviation Organization were kicked out at the request of Beijing. Beijing has also been less hesitant to arrest and detain Taiwan nationals for crimes that were committed outside the PRC. So they've been prosecuted for crimes. So there's in effect a kind of extraterritoriality that Beijing has pursued over Taiwan nationals that they did not before. Most noticeably, particularly recently, the number of PLA air and sea exercises in Taiwan territorial air and sea have increased significantly, including deliberate incursions across the midline of the Taiwan Strait. So this is all part of the hard side of Beijing's pressure campaign against the Tsai administration. The soft elements of Beijing's campaign have included selective engagement with non-DPP political elites, most notably the mayor of Taipei, Ke Wen-je, visited Shanghai as a kind of sister city forum exchange. And because he had previously expressed that both sides of the strait were part of the same family, that was language that was more acceptable to Beijing, and so he was allowed to visit Shanghai. Beijing has also rolled out economic measures to try to entice skilled Taiwanese in particular to move to the Chinese mainland and take up work there. Most notably, most critically, they've targeted engineers in Taiwan's semiconductor manufacturing industry. And Beijing has also rolled out expanded legal rights and benefits for Taiwanese living on the mainland. So Taiwanese can get a residence card, they can then access social security benefits and free schooling for their children if they live in a city that offers that. So most of these measures appeared from outside of Taiwan to be working. I've argued that Taiwan's that the Tsai administration's struggles in her first term actually had much more to do with domestic politics, I think, than cross-strait relations. But from Beijing's perspective, this pressure campaign seemed to be at least coinciding with a significant decline in Tsai Ing-wen's approval ratings. And so 2.5 years into her term, she was polling at under 30%. There was a pretty significant and sustained downturn in support for her. And so it's at her nadir that the 9-in-1 local elections are held and the KMT wins those going away. The KMT wins 14 local races up from 6. Han Guoyu, as I've mentioned, is the headliner there, wins a shocking victory in Kaohsiung. He's supported by pro-unification media in Taiwan who have him on. He's on the front page of the newspaper. He's on every television channel. He's dominating the coverage. And a lot of these pro-unification media are in some way, shape, or form linked to the CCP influence campaign in Taiwan as well. And so Han Guoyu becomes a little bit colored by the support for him coming from what are pro-Beijing media in Taiwan. After this election, though, it looks like Tsai Ing-wen might not actually win re-election. The KMT's prospects suddenly look strong again. Han Guoyu looks like he might be the presidential candidate. And overall, and as there are probably people in the audience who remember, there was a lot of fear at this time that the CCP might actually be effectively undermining Taiwan democracy. That, of course, didn't happen. Over the last year, Tsai Ing-wen's approval ratings shot back up. Han Guoyu's approval ratings fell. About 6 months, they traded positions. Tsai Ing-wen, by the end of the campaign period, looked like she was going to win going away. And she ended up, in the end, coming in with an even larger share of the vote than she did in 2016, and on much higher turnout, almost 10% higher turnout than in 2016. So this was a real triumph for Tsai Ing-wen and the DPP and a real setback for Beijing's attempt to defeat them in this election. Why did this happen? Well, I think there are some fundamental strengths of Taiwan's democracy that can tell us something about why this happened. First off, as Lanhee mentioned earlier, Taiwan's electoral management system is exemplary. I wish the United States were closer to Taiwan's system. It is almost unhackable. It is very low tech. They use all paper ballots. Their count is transparent. It takes place right after the election day closes. The results are counted up within a couple of hours, so it's very fast. The polling station is actually open for the count to anybody who wants to walk in and observe. So even a foreigner like myself can walk in and just watch the count. It's very transparent. And that has the added benefit of undercutting rumor mongering about stealing votes or trends that seem to be different from what the national polls have predicted. If you know the partisan predilections of your polling district, your polling station, and you watch the count yourself, you can get a pretty good idea of how the national count is trending. So the count that I watched was in a pretty KMT-friendly precinct in Taipei. Tsai Ing-wen was neck and neck with Han Kuo-yu there. And so I could gather within just a few minutes that Tsai Ing-wen was going to blow Han Kuo-yu out. This was a deep blue district and they're neck and neck. So in other places, Tsai Ing-wen was going to have a much larger lead. And that increases confidence then in the election results that are reported. Taiwan has a very institutionalized party system. The KMT and the DPP have been around a really long time. Everybody knows their positions on cross-strait issues. And so the awareness of the threat posed by China to Taiwan or the opportunity posed by China to Taiwan is something that most voters already have. It's not an issue that the CCP can kind of fly in under the radar on. And in fact, it's the issue that the parties have been separated on really for 30 years. So it's a very salient issue. And it means that Pan-Green voters especially are inherently suspicious of pro-China messaging. So if the CCP is targeting DPP voters, they're not going to make much headway with a message that unification is great, you get all these benefits. There's an inherent suspicion of that message on the Pan-Green side, which makes it a harder case to crack than, say, in Australia or New Zealand, where this is not, relations with China are not a salient political issue for the most part. So much of the CCP's success elsewhere has happened because it's covert. Most people don't know that influence operations are taking place. It's just not true in Taiwan. It's very clear who is pro-unification, who is pro-independence, and it's hard for someone to advocate for pro-unification without being questioned about whether they're receiving support or money from the mainland side of the strait. Taiwan does have some persistent democratic weaknesses, most prominently the traditional media environment in Taiwan, like many places now, is hyper-competitive, it's unprofitable, there are generally poor ethics practiced in journalism, and there are radio, TV, and newspapers all susceptible to Chinese influence ops. So the most prominent example is the Zhongguo Shibao or the China Times, which it has since 2009 taken a very pro-Beijing stance in both its news reporting and its editorial line. So I have an example here of four cover sheets, the broadsheets of four daily newspapers in Taiwan in the summer of 2019. The three not circled are all covering Hong Kong protests. China Times is covering divisions within the DPP. They don't want to talk about the Hong Kong protests. Campaign finance in Taiwan is weakly regulated. Political parties generally need to raise outside money in addition to public funding that they get. This has been a consistent problem for years in Taiwan. There is, as Jinshou mentioned a long history of vote buying and mobilization via local factions in Taiwan to win elections. These networks have generally deteriorated over time, and the prosecutor's offices and the judiciary in Taiwan have actually been pretty effective at cracking down on vote buying. And so I don't view this as the glaring weakness in Taiwan's political system. It's actually fairly difficult to buy a local election now without getting caught and prosecuted for it. And then finally, religious associations in Taiwan have been a significant target of United Front work for the CCP. And they've been lightly regulated for a long time. So in 2020, how did Taiwan counter the CCP influence campaign? Well, the media regulators became much more proactive, more aggressive about punishing bad media behavior, unbalanced coverage, rumor mongering. The National Communications Commission actually fined China Television, a pro-Beijing TV station, for their coverage. The DPP-controlled legislature passed several amendments to strengthen legal protections against United Front work, including an amendment to the Political Party Act. And as Jinsho has mentioned, prosecutors' offices are pretty professional and pretty independent. They stepped up investigations and prosecuted pro-Chinese voices who were clearly violating some of these new laws, regulating working for agents based on the mainland. I have some remaining concerns about Taiwan's democratic resilience in the face of Chinese sharp power. One is Taiwan's media industry, I think, is still quite problematic. There may be a need for a more robust public television service or central news agency presence. I think campaign finance reform is an easy way to strengthen Taiwan's democracy. Providing more public funding for political parties eliminates the need to go to private donors and certainly to money that may be ultimately sourced back to mainland China. Strengthening prosecutors' offices further, I think giving them the resources, including personnel and funds, to go after the rising threats to democratic institutions would help. And there is surprisingly low trust among ordinary Taiwanese in the judiciary. And so there's a lot of talk about judicial reform these days, which Jinsho is actually at the forefront of. And so if Taiwan is able to strengthen the kind of rule of law culture, I think that would help in the face of Chinese sharp power operations as well. So last slide here, I'll wrap up. Do we have comparative lessons from Taiwan that might apply to other democracies in the region and beyond that are facing a sharp power threat from China? The first is, I think in Taiwan, it's very clear that they are under threat from the CCP, and transparency about what CCP agents are doing in Taiwan is a good thing. Exposure really kind of takes a lot of the power out of the threats or the operations that the CCP is engaging in. And so a good example, last summer, there was a foreign reporter who wrote a story documenting that the Taiwan Affairs Office in Beijing was actually regularly dictating coverage in China Times. And by documenting that and publishing it in a foreign outlet, that really kind of solidified what had often been rumored in Taiwanese politics. It undercut a lot of the China Times ability to influence the electorate. Second, nonpartisan institutions in democracies are really important in pushing back. Prosecutors in Taiwan, intelligence bureaus, and regulators all really did step up against this perceived threat, particularly after 2018, which was kind of a wake-up call for the state institutions in Taiwan. Private tech companies in Taiwan, Facebook and Line are the most prominent. They were actually much more proactive in 2020 in countering rumor mongering on their platforms. I think they could have done more, but they were certainly more effective than in 2018. And then finally, and most provocatively, I want to caution us against thinking that Chinese sharp power and influence ops are really effective. What I've seen in Taiwan suggests that they're actually quite clumsy about what they're trying to do, and that they're handicapped either by bureaucratic incompetence or by ideology. And I'll leave you with one example from last year. The former DPP president, Annette Liu, attempted to run an independent campaign challenging Tsai Ing-wen, so to run from her pro-independence left. And rather than promote her candidacy, the pro-unification media just mocked her or ignored her. If what you want to do is foster division within your main opponent, she's probably somebody you should have played up if you're doing a Chinese influence operation. And so I'm a little bit skeptical that the CCP has actually optimized their ability to engage in some real disinformation or information warfare that furthers their long-term goals in a place like Taiwan. And that suggests actually that while we shouldn't dismiss the threat, we shouldn't make it out to be worse than it is in other democratic societies as well. This is a manageable problem, I think. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Karis. We will now move to our discussant, Larry Diamond.
Let me begin by saying it proved to be a manageable problem in Taiwan. And it was manageable in Taiwan because Taiwan is made really far from perfect, as you understand from listening to the papers on Taiwan, far from perfect, but nevertheless, really, I think, extraordinarily impressive progress in terms of corruption, rule of law, and improvements in the quality of liberal democracy. And I'd say if countries don't achieve greater strength and resilience in corruption, rule of law, and the quality of democracy and transparency, it won't be a manageable problem in other societies. And I think that is a very important lesson from this panel. Let me begin by just giving you all some evidence that will back up the point I'm trying to make. If you go to the World Bank's governance indicators and just track how Taiwan has changed since the first year that the World Bank's governance indicators started measuring rule of law, transparency, and other measures of the quality of governance in countries in 1996, which was coincidentally the year that Taiwan became a full democracy, you find that Taiwan's percentile score on the rule of law improved from 70 in 1996 to 82nd percentile among all the countries of the world in 2004, slipped back a little bit to 79 after the corruption scandals at the end of Chen Shui-bian's presidency in 2009, and rose to 85 in 2019. And there was a very similar pattern in control of corruption. And I'll just say, Taiwan stood at the 73rd percentile in 1996 and stands at the 83rd percentile in 2019. It's not perfect, but today Taiwan, I'd say, is as robust and transparent and liberal a democracy as any in Asia. And I think the improvements in rule of law, control of corruption, and quality of democracy have had a lot to do with Taiwan's ability to repel PRC sharp power and penetration activities in recent years and in the 2000 presidential election campaign. I fully agree with the remarks that Kars Templeman made on the additional steps Taiwan could take that would greatly improve its resilience. But let me now speak more generally about what we can learn from these two papers on Taiwan and from Lavina Lee's excellent paper on China's BRI efforts and its sharp power projection efforts around the world. And I would just stress these seven lessons in terms of making countries better able to repel China's sharp power influence activities. First of all, I'd say a transcendent lesson is the need for vigilance, to build awareness and understanding in societies around the world that are the targets of PRC influence activities, which is most societies in the world. We need vigilance in terms of the capacity to detect, to recognize, and expose illegitimate PRC influence activities, efforts to pressure and sway opinion and policy by means that are, to quote our watchwords from the recent Australian Prime Minister, means that are covert, coercive, or corrupting. That is really the definition of sharp power. And this means in part promoting understanding, which we're going to seek to do in our project on China's global sharp power, of the United Front as a phenomenon that seeks to burrow into the deep tissues of democracies around the world and use coercion and corruption behind the scenes, out of public view, to try and win influence and co-opt agents of influence in the future. Second, the need for resilience. We need to do more to build institutional capacity and integrity in the way that Taiwan did for itself in the last 20 years, to better resist PRC, United Front, and sharp power activities. This means in part promoting knowledge, but it also means developing the capacity for investigative journalism, for researching and exposing relationships, linkages, and activities that compromise democratic integrity and transparency, and that enable China to project sharp power and enable the United Front to do the classic work that it does. Here, I think there are enormous lessons that can be drawn, partial though the progress was, in developing judicial independence, in what Taiwan did to fight what has been called black gold politics, and to make Taiwan, therefore, a better rule of law state, more resilient to repel foreign influence activities in politics. Third, I think an inference that can be drawn from Lavina's paper is that we need to build and offer support for societal efforts at developing cross-national networks to repel PRC influence activities. This is going to require collaboration among governments and civil societies to learn lessons and to develop common tools and information sharing for exposing and resisting PRC sharp power activities, for developing stronger, more independent media and civil society organizations, for rolling back, as Taiwan was able to do, entrenched systems of clientelism and corruption, and developing better capacities for intelligence and law enforcement, for, as I said, investigative journalism, and for sharing intelligence. It means more radical systems of transparency and counter-corruption on an international level. I would say the open government partnership has a lot of promise here in terms of making societies more resilient. We need stronger laws against the projection of dirty money into politics and policymaking. So our own Foreign Agent Registration Act, the new laws that Australia has adopted in this regard, stronger campaign finance laws, all of these have an important lesson to bear for societies in using transparency to make open societies more resilient against PRC influence activities. The sixth lesson is, I think we need alternative flows of development assistance, and in particular, development assistance for the building and strengthening of infrastructure in developing countries. One reason why the PRC has had something of an open field in terms of BRI and its use as a tool in projecting influence is that Western development agencies have gotten out of the business of building roads and other physical infrastructure. And I think we need to get back into the competitive game, either through the World Bank or through new transnational flows of development assistance to aid countries in building infrastructure in ways that do not depend on China's Belt and Road Initiative. The seventh principle I would offer is conditionality, that US and peer democracies need to make clear that if countries throw in their lot in non-transparent ways with PRC United Front activities, PRC United Front companies like Huawei, there will be consequences. And finally, we need to strengthen our own democracies. As Mike Brown, the head of the Defense Innovation Unit, said in a very important presentation to our China Global Sharp Power conference on China AI and human rights, we are in a superpower marathon with the People's Republic of China. We, the democracies of the world, I would now say Taiwan, Korea, Japan, the European Union democracies, and of course, Australia and the United States, we need to make clear that democracies can function transparently and effectively to, first of all, counter China's sharp power activities, and second of all, to work effectively, to grow economically, to deliver a better deal to their own societies, and to manage the COVID-19 pandemic. And if we don't show that democracies can function effectively, dynamically, to deliver economic growth and protect public health, it's going to be hard in the long run to counter China's ambition to project global sharp power around the world.
Larry, thank you for those fantastic remarks and reflections on our papers today. What I would like to do is to give our panelists each a brief opportunity to respond or react to anything Larry mentioned in his comments, and then we will be going, of course, to questions from the audience, of which we have many, so we'll try and fit in as many as we can first. So I'll turn it back to Dr. Lee to see if you have any reaction to Larry's comments or to the comments from any other panelists today.
Thank you. I agree with everything Larry has just said. It was brilliantly put. I suppose I would say that one thing that I would add to my own remarks, drawing from what Larry said, is that you know, the when we think of the BRI, I think mostly the emphasis is on things like debt trap diplomacy and the creation of client states through the use of infrastructure funding. Now, what I was trying to get at in my paper is that is obviously a very important problem, and something that a lot of what Larry has just put forward, I think, gets at the heart of the weaknesses or the vulnerabilities of a lot of countries, particularly in the Indo-Pacific, that are weak democracies with weak institutions. But the broader point, I think, is that democracy promotion itself, beyond the geostrategic implications of the BRI, is also fundamentally undermining the broader narrative about the success and opportunity that liberal democracy can bring. So I think all of your points that were made in the other papers about Taiwan and what Larry has drawn out about how Taiwan itself has improved and built upon its own defences against external sharp power, I think are great lessons for other countries. And perhaps that's also our what we're drawing out of our conference, is that our focus should also be in helping countries in the Indo-Pacific that are already existing democracies, albeit weak ones, where we have something to build on, where we're not going to necessarily be accused of imposing values from the outside. We're effectively assisting countries that profess to be democracies to be stronger and more resilient democracies. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Wang, any reactions?
Yeah, thank you very much. Professor Diamond, yeah, your point, all your point, I agree. Yeah, I just a little bit respond to the audience question. In fact, in Taipei, they are Miao Boya and Jiang Wan, they are new face, and they are new campaign strategy, so they can won the election. However, in the New Taipei, 新北市, 桃园, 台中, the New Power Party, the 时代力量, did not win any seat. And in Thailand, they only win one seat. The councilwoman, Lin Yin, the performance is very, very great, very excellent. She challenged many, many policy from the Thailand city government. However, they did not change. She cannot change any policy because there's just only one person, this kind of person in this council. And in the Huelilua in Taiwan, in fact, the Ji Jindang and the Shidai Liang did not nominate any candidate. So I think we need to encourage some new candidate into the party. And the second question is about the distrust of the judiciary. I think the Taiwan judiciary is not perfect, even though they match the judicial independence, much progress in this kind of perspective. However, Taiwan people have more higher expectation from the judiciary. Also, so now the judiciary have to do more. And also, in fact, Taiwan the media is pretty bad. I don't understand it better. Everyone can understand. So when some decision from the court did not explain the decision pretty careful. So the media just report selective and sometimes wrong, report the decision wrong. So the people cannot receive very correct the information. And I think it's a good thing in fact the judicial and does they just build up the new information office. They just want to expand every decision, important decision from the court. I think it takes some time to let Taiwan the people to learn the law, to understand, to understand, you know, what happened in this call. I think it takes some time. Yeah, but this is a good start for the call, for the judicial yuan. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Templeman.
Yeah, I'll keep this very short because I want to hear from the audience, but I'll just pick up on something that Professor Diamond said, and that is the role of non-state actors in countering PRC influence. In Taiwan, the social media companies actually had they were on the front lines of countering Chinese disinformation. And I should add, not just disinformation from China, but disinformation that was organic, that was circulating, rumors raised and circulated by Taiwanese themselves. And Facebook actually was quite aggressive about clamping down on rumors, and they partnered with a local NGO, Taiwan Fact Check Center, to write basically debunking stories of various false rumors online. And so there's an opportunity here, I think, to take that model potentially to other countries as well. And there's a big onus, I think, on the social media companies to develop a better code of conduct, a kind of set of best practices, in the same way that journalists over the 20th century sort of developed a professional code of honor and code of conduct to govern good journalism. We need a similar kind of policy that could be shared across democracies for how tech companies should handle online moderation of political speech.
Thank you very much. Why don't we go to some questions from the audience, since we do have a number of them. Let me begin by asking a question from Kennedy Kidd. This is to Dr. Lee. Kennedy asks, at first, Russia responded with reticence toward China's BRI, worried that the move would undermine Moscow's influence and future plans. They have since changed their tune and are now one of the initiative's biggest investors. Why? What changed? Does the BRI conflict with Russia's goals?
Okay, from the outset, thanks for the question. I'm not necessarily an expert on the BRI in that particular region. My research focuses more on the Indo-Pacific. But I would, my educated guess, analysis of it would be that Russia, I'm sure, is its access to infrastructure funding from Western sources has been severely curtailed. And I think out of some sense of economic necessity, it has had to look at the BRI in terms of its investment in infrastructure. So we know that Russia is heavily dependent on exports of its resources, but also of arms. They're very major sources of income for Russia. So I think out of some level of desperation, they're moving towards the BRI just to develop their own resources in their own country. Now, at the same time, I would think as well that the Eurasian Economic Union is Russia's big grand blueprint to exert a sphere of influence in its own backyard, and the BRI overshadows and really undermines that objective. So I would think that Russia would support those infrastructure projects that are energy related, that might be developing the infrastructure, energy infrastructure of Central Asian countries, where oil and gas pipelines, etc., are in fact passing through Russia and onto Europe, because that in fact enhances Russia's national interests. And any project that actually bypasses Russia, I think Russia would not be supportive of it.
Thank you for that. We have a question from Glenn Tiffert for Dr. Wong. Glenn says, Dr. Wong seems to tell a story of weakening internal party discipline within the KMT and cultural change among younger judicial personnel. The first is well documented, but what accounts for the rising independence of younger judges and prosecutors?
In fact, the many before the demigration, there are many corrupt In fact, most judges are corrupt. In fact, I have an interview, they told me more than 80% male judge and prosecutor, you know, have been corrupt except the bribery. However, you can see in the past decade, only for the people, the prosecutor and judge have been charged the corruption. Very few. However, this kind of the people, the judge, you know, they are reported widely by the media. So I think the young and the prosecutor, they are much more professional. However, they are less experienced. Also, they have some problem. They did not respond to the social demand pretty much. This is why the right now the judiciary want to do. Also, I want to add one point. In fact, the trust the judiciary during the authoritarian regime, the period is very, very high. And every democracy, even the Taiwan judicial democracy, had much progress in the dependence. However, the distrust is very, very low. So I think the most they are big the gap between the reality and the people perception. So the young people, I think, is very, very. Isn't it very, very good? And their personality, they did not cooperate. However, I think they did not have social pretty strong the social experience. Many the young judge and prosecutor, they just graduate from the school and they just the take exam into the institute and judge academy, and then become the judge and prosecutor. So they are very young. I think this is a big problem for the Taiwan judiciary.
We have a question. I'm going to address this to Karis Templeton, excuse me. It's from Tom Finger, and he asks, do Taiwan people vote for Tsai because they support her policies or because the PRC wants her to lose? Or is sharp power so counterproductive that they would vote for a candidate from any party opposed by the PRC?
So I would think of it like this. There's a trade-off. So the opportunity, the mainland is an opportunity and a threat to Taiwan. It's an economic opportunity if China's economy is growing, if the PRC is willing to kind of back off and allow Taiwan some diplomatic space. But it's also a threat because it wants to annex Taiwan. It wants to take over its political system, to ban certain kinds of speech, and ultimately control the island for its own ends. And so Taiwanese people have to make a choice about which of those is more pressing. And in the run-up to 2020, I would argue, and in fact, in the run-up to 2016 as well, the security and sovereignty concerns, in other words, viewing the mainland more as a threat than an opportunity, dominated the economic concerns. Beijing unwittingly, I think, played a role in raising the salience of sovereignty and security issues. Xi Jinping, for instance, gave a speech on January 2nd, 2019 that was very poorly received in Taiwan. And you immediately saw Tsai Ing-wen's numbers spike. And so because she's the leader of the China Skeptical Party, she's going to benefit if there's if you kind of make more salient the threat that's coming from the PRC. The other obvious thing is the rise of the Hong Kong protests starting in June of 2019. That just dominated coverage in Taiwan. The Hong Kong one country, two systems model is what Beijing is offering for Taiwan. And as a consequence, it is the only thing, the erosion of one country, two systems in Taiwan or in Hong Kong is actually problematic for any promises that Beijing is making to Taiwan. It just completely undercuts their credibility. And so the combination of Xi Jinping's speech, the Hong Kong protests, and then the broader sense that Beijing was taking the directly elected leader of the Taiwanese electorate and basically saying, we don't care that you were directly elected. We don't care that you won this election. You know, if you don't bend to our will, we're going to squeeze you. And so there's, again, that insistence that you bend to our will or else we'll put a lot of pressure on you, just it raises the threat part of that threat versus opportunity. It raises the salience of that. And so I think ultimately, Beijing's, the more that they pursue the hard part of the soft, hard trade-off, that dual track strategy there is, the more they undercut their own long-term objectives in Taiwan.
Thank you. So why don't we conclude with one last question, and this is directed to Dr. Li, but really if any of you would like to follow on, please feel free, but Dr. Li first. What role do you think Taiwan can play in countering the threats that the BRI and I suppose other sharp power initiatives pose to the international community?
Okay, I think Taiwan has an important role through its new southbound. Now, the southbound policy is a means by which it provides to the Pacific, to South and Southeast Asia. And I think I think what Larry was talking about, I completely agree that there is a lot of scope for Taiwan to join along with other democracies in our region to support democratic practices and institutions and accountability mechanisms within Southeast Asia. Now, primarily, you know, Taiwan can't compete just as Australia or India. We can't compete in terms of providing direct infrastructure investment, but what we can do is support technical assistance, the capacity of governments to actually be able to assess whether a particular project that's put forward and advanced by China is actually feasible or has any economic benefit, or professes labor and environmental standards that are actually going to be achieved. A lot of these small countries just don't have the technical skills and capacities to assess properly, and then they find themselves in a potential debt trap type situation. So we don't want to be, we want to assist countries, and I think other democracies should band together with Taiwan and be part of this southbound policy, or Taiwan be part of the Indo-Pacific strategy in that sense. And I think as part of this southbound policy, they're already supporting NGOs, civil society, the kinds of things we've been talking about, the development of the rule of law and the free press. You know, if we're talking about the importance of transparency shines a light on corruption. So we want to actually assist these societies to develop the ability to shine a light on corruption when they see it. And I think there's also scope through the Digital Silk Road. Again, it's education to help countries understand what the potential malign impacts of adopting parts of the Digital Silk Road are, and the importance of protecting privacy, limiting the use of surveillance and artificial intelligence for facial recognition technology. All of those things, a lot of countries, I've even read of countries in Europe that have bought into these systems unwittingly, not knowing where the data is going and what it's being used for and how it can be misused. So, you know, there's a lot of scope there for capacity building assistance to understand the pernicious aspects of the BRI. I think Taiwan can be part of that.
Thank you very much. Anyone else on that issue before we wrap up this afternoon and evening and morning for some? Well, thank you to the panelists, to Dr. Diamond, Professor Diamond, for his comments as well. And with that, Glenn Tiffert, back to you.
Thank you very much, Lanny. And I'd like to thank Larry and our three panelists for a phenomenal session and discussion. We hope that you'll be able to attend the concluding session of this conference on Thursday, or if you're in Asia and Oceania, on Friday at the same time. That one is entitled China's Rise and Prospects for Security and Stability in the Indo-Pacific Region. It includes a stellar cast of experts and former National Security Advisor to the President of the United States, H.R. McMaster, now a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, will open the event with a keynote speech. We hope that you'll join us. Thank you very much.